Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
To the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, greetings, you commie, homo-loving sons of guns. Sean Penn last night. Oh, one of the best lines. Anyhow, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot of the news today, which we will be getting to. One thing in particular, the filibuster rules. Something that I didn't know that I want to share with you about one of the... Perhaps you've been giving Harry Reid a bad rap, and perhaps it's been going on for a couple of decades. We'll get back to that after this. But first, Roger Simon is with us. He is the author of Blacklisting Myself, Memoir of a Hollywood Apostate in the Age... Say that again?
Apostate.
You're right. Apostate in the age of terror. It's one of those words that I read a lot and I very rarely ever say out loud. In the age of terror. Thank you, Roger. Roger is also the CEO of Pajamas Media, the website pajamasmedia.org, an Academy Award-nominated screenwriter, novelist, author of the new book Blacklisting Myself, etc. Do I have that right?
It's fine with me.
Okay. Roger, your book suggests that since you went from being a radical liberal to a radical conservative, after 9/11, actually, you write about in your book, that Hollywood has been blacklisting you and other conservatives. This baffles me because we have a situation here where, for example, when you look at in television, obviously that's not Hollywood, but in television, any TV show will basically have, you know, 2-to-1 conservatives to liberals. And in fact, real liberals or real progressives are almost never represented on television. In other media, I know my friend Ed Asner was clearly blacklisted. Phil Donahue was pulled off. You and Ron Silver seem to be the only guys making this case. Tell me about it.
Well, first of all, I only speak for features because I never worked in TV, although now I work on the internet. I never worked in TV, so I don't consider myself authority. I don't even watch TV that much. I watch TV on the internet, and I watch the Laker games, but I'm not a TV person. I'm a feature person, so you may be right about TV. I mean, I don't claim expertise, but certainly in the feature world, it's dominated that way. But by the way, I don't consider myself a radical or conservative, whatever the hell that means. I don't consider myself even a conservative. I think the terms conservative and liberal and progressive and all those are yesterday's news.
Well, you had a phrase in your book, in Blacklisting Myself, page 95. I actually spent some time with your book. And page 95, you said...
Some time, or did you read it? Because the last chapters go through the whole thing.
Yeah, I know. I didn't read every word in your book. That would be impossible with every book that I review. But I spent several hours with it, and I don't know what percentage of it I read, but a fair amount. And you said, I had discovered something interesting about myself. I was no longer the kid who marched in front of the... You're talking about your earlier days. Who marched in front of the UN shouting, Ho Chi Minh, Vietnam, Viet Cong is going to win. I was a patriot who wanted America to win, who wanted people across the world to be free. And
if you call that a radical conservative, I guess...
Well, let me just question the premise. How is it that our... First of all, what would it have meant to have won in Vietnam? What would that have looked like? Installing a Shah-like government? How would that have made the world free?
Wait. I was talking about current days, not Vietnam.
You're talking about Vietnam. You're saying a patriot who wanted America to win and wanted America people across the world to be free.
Now I do. Not then. And in those days, I was a protester. And my feelings about the Vietnam War now, looking back at Vietnam, I'm not talking about Iraq and Vietnam are so different. It's totally different.
Okay, well, let's take that. Right. You say in the book that the 9/11 for you was a seminal moment. It was a turning point moment for you.
Yes, it was. But if you read the book, you see there was a big chapter on the O.J. trial when I discussed the beginnings of the changes in some of my views. So
no, I read that, in fact, actually.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
But the point of 9/11, it seems to me that there are a number of conservatives out there, people who call themselves conservatives, who, can't get their mind around the idea that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, and B, somehow think that invading let me even take it to a larger picture than that. Somehow are experiencing some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder around 9/11. Not, you know, when Tim McVeigh blew up.
Wait a minute.
Let me set up the premise, and you can lay out as long as you want. Okay.
Right.
When Tim McVeigh blew up the McMurrah building in Oklahoma City, it was an act of terrorism against the United States that resulted in the death of hundreds of people as a consequence of blowing up a building. Bill Clinton said, this guy's a sociopath or a psychopath. He's a mass murderer. We're going to track him down. We're going to punish him. The people in Kansas City got closure. America got closure. Tim McVeigh got what was arguably what he deserved. The people associated with him got time in prison. George Bush, on the other hand, not only did not use that opportunity to point out that this was a crime, he inflated the importance of Osama bin Laden, who at that time only had 20,000 followers, according to the best estimates of the CIA. He turned him into a superhero so that George could become a superhero. And he took people, I would, you know, respectfully say, like you, who were suffering post-traumatic stress disorder, who were terrified by what happened.
Wait a minute. I was not terrified at all. That's not my personality. If you read the book, you would see no sense of terror in it whatsoever. So I don't know where that comes from. But you can put words in my mouth all you want. But Mr. Hartman, and make assumptions about me, but I will tell you many of your assumptions are wrong. I'm radically pro-gay marriage. I'm a very different kind of cat from who you think I am.
No, I get that.
I think your show is, you're being very unsophisticated in your way of dealing with me.
Well, I may well be, but here on page 163 of your book, you say 9/11 happened. The U.S. suddenly had a common Islamo-fascist enemy. We didn't. We had a criminal who had attacked us.
Well, you know, there's where we agree. I think Islamofascism is a huge ideology that many, many, literally hundreds of millions of people are attracted to.
I agree with you, and it wouldn't be if George Bush hadn't responded the way he did.
I see, sir. From my point of view, that view is, with all due respect, essentially racist. Because what you're assuming in it is that these people whose views have not changed, the Muslim Brotherhood is way before 9/11. Qutb and Syed Qutb, I'm sure you know who he is.
I do, and I was in Egypt when Anwar Sadat was assassinated by the Muslim Brotherhood.
He way predates 9/11. This ideology is nothing new, and it connects up with very old. The Mahdi is nothing new. These things are very ancient and heavily believed. So I don't understand why you think this is my fear. I am not an idiot, sir. Have some respect for me, and I will have respect for you. When I was on the left, I knew the ideology inside and out.
Roger,
I can tell you about the Third International.
Roger, I'm really trying not to personalize this. What I am pointing
out.
My apologies if you're taking it that way. My point is that after 9/11, the day after 9/11, in downtown Tehran, they had a candlelight vigil in support of the United States.
Yes, we know
all
that.
Around the world, we had this extraordinary moment. We had Afghanistan saying, if you have evidence that Osama bin Laden is responsible for this, we will turn him over to a third country for a trial. And George Bush said, no, I want to be the neighborhood bully.
You're personalizing it. I'm not a Bush pro. Bush is not the issue. History is the issue.
No, I'm saying that what Bush did is he terrorized a whole generation of Americans. From reading your book, I'm in the worst form of psychobabble. I'll raise my hand, you know, even though I'm a psychotherapist, I'll raise my hand and say it right there. I may well be wrong. It seems to me that you were frightened by that event, and that terror is carrying on in this ideology.
Frightened?
Yeah.
I was It was a moment when I saw history moving in a certain direction more than before. I wasn't particularly frightened. I didn't walk down the street with any kind of fear. That's not my personality. I'm the reverse. I'm a bit of a rabble-rouser and a bit of a pain. So, I mean, it's not really fear. I think you've got it wrong with all due respect for your psychotherapeutic background. You know, I've been in analysis. I've been there myself. This is not particularly my gestalt.
But you're saying liberal is the new conservative. In your chapter, Satori and the Modern Age of Conservative Liberals, and we're talking with Roger Simon, his new book, Blacklisting Myself. I often said that I'm uncomfortable being called a conservative. It's so square. And then you go on to say liberal is the new conservative. We've got to take a break here for in just a moment. But when we get back from it, if you can stick around for a moment, if you will, Roger.
I'd be glad.
Okay, great. I'd like to know what you're talking about in that context. I found the book, frankly, fascinating. And I recommend people check it out. Blacklisting Myself is the book. Roger L. Simon is the author. And we'll be right back. It's Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. 866-303-2270, by the way, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com, for a free video stream.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Civil rights leaders are a pain in the neck. Can't hold a candle to Chiang Kai-shek. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Band of bombers are afraid of a fight. Peace hurts business and that ain't right. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand. And you ride right along to Never Never Land.
It's your radio support group for We the People of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with me. Roger L. Simon, the author of the new book, Blacklisting Myself, Academy Award-winning nominated screenwriter, novelist, author of this new book, Blacklisting Myself, is with us. Also president of PajamasMedia.org. And I'm curious at some point, this isn't a particularly long segment, Roger, but you know why you chose to send Joe the Plumber over to Israel as Pajama Media. But first, you say liberal is the new conservative. Throughout the book, you know, your book starts out with your shall we say, liberal past or even activist past. And to this day, you say that you're uncomfortable being called a conservative. It's so square. Liberal is the new conservative, like 50 is the new 60, that sort of thing.
I'm having fun there, obviously.
Well, you know, I almost get a sense.
Here's what I mean by it. If you look at something like South Park, you see that there is a kind of hipness to South Park that you don't see in liberal stuff anymore. The liberal shibboleths have been the same since I was a kid, and I was a kid a long time ago. So it's just something to examine. That's all I'm saying.
It seems, though, that I mean, you point out that with regard to social issues, you're more liberal.
I'm more liberal than the president.
Right.
I mean, the president does not favor gay marriage. I unequivocally.
Right. Exactly. And you know, perhaps you should identify yourself as a libertarian. I refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. But you know, it's sort of in that category. But here's my question: are you just following fashion trends?
Well, I could be accused of that. I'm not, you know, maybe I am.
Why this change uniquely on the issue of the war?
I mean, why would a guy like me follow fashion trends when I had a pretty decent Hollywood career, which I was getting a lot of money from? I'd be a fool, but then, okay.
Why does Tom Cruise follow fashion trends? I don't know why people.
I don't know. Yeah, no, exactly. Maybe I am. Excuse me. That's fine. I mean, maybe I am. I don't know.
The question behind the question is why?
What?
Why would you, if you actually had a worldview that was grounded in an ideology that
I don't believe worldview should be grounded in ideology anymore. I used to believe that. But I think that ideology is dangerous in general, all sorts of ideologies, and should be constantly examined and re-examined.
So the difference, for example...
The ideas of left and right, for example, are very old. You know, they come from the French Assemblée, 1789, where people were seated.
Well, the phrase left and right, the ideas of left and right, you know, arguably come from the early days of the Enlightenment, the idea that... either humans are intrinsically evil, which is the foundation of conservative thought, and therefore we need to select the very best among us to govern us, versus the liberal thought, which was put forward by Jean-Jacques Rousseau and John Locke and Thomas Jefferson, that people are fundamentally good, and therefore the largest number of people who participate in governments, the better. I mean,
what about those of us who don't make such a judgment? I mean, that's the kind of...
Well,
What is there other than those two choices?
And I'm not a polar opposite guy, but, you know, are people good or bad?
I don't have a particular some people are good and some are bad. I don't really particularly have a view on that. I just do the best I can. I think that's a kind of searching for a security blanket, if you don't mind my saying so.
No. Feel free to flip it around on me.
I don't think it's like... I don't think it's a kind of strange decision that people make. I'm not a religious person. Anyone reading my book will see that. I learned more from Buddhism than I did from other religions, although I'm proud to be Jewish and I hate anti-Semitism. But I'm not a religious person at all.
But why?
So I find science more interesting and more revelatory for me.
Yeah.
The existence of God is above my pay grade. Sorry.
Sure. Yeah, so, above mine too. We're to the point where, or exists at least a monotheistic God. We're to the point where, or an anthropomorphic God. Let's get right to the topic here. You say blacklisting myself. Hollywood is blacklisting conservatives.
I'll tell you what I mean. It's a subtle thing. In the old days, the old blacklist was a horrible thing over and out. I'm not going to argue in favor of what was done during the McCarthy period. It was despicable. One word for it. Now, today, what you see in Hollywood is a kind of a shadowy blacklist of the nature you have the country clubs against Catholics, Jews, etc., black people back in the day. You don't see it against someone like Clint Eastwood. That's ridiculous. Everyone would bow down to work with Clint Eastwood.
And he's very conservative. He's not blacklisted.
Yes. At the level of story meetings, writers, directors who aren't, because 99.9999% of the people who work in Hollywood are not Clint Eastwood, as anybody would know. So toward them, yes, there is more difficulty, more problems.
Could that be simply a symptom of our culture becoming more progressive?
Well, no, I know you'd like to think so, but I think, for example, during the Bush period, if you went into a story meeting, a Bush bash was part of the ritual. I mean, it was like, what would you like Perrier with ice? And by the way, screw Bush.
Yeah.
It was just normal.
Okay, people can read about it at Blacklisting Myself, pajamasmedia.org, the website. We never did get to that question. .com, my apologies. We'll have to get you back to talk about Joe the Plumber one of these days. Roger Simon, Blacklisting Myself. Thanks for Roger for dropping by. Good talking with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, unspinning the news of the day. I find this so fascinating. Here we had, and as you know, I don't trash people when they're not on the air with us, so I don't want to personalize this to our last guest, but just broadly speaking, we have people all across the United States, including a lot of people who identify themselves as Reagan Democrats or people who say that they believe in traditional American values of we're all in this together. And they don't think of our police departments as socialist, which they are. And they don't think of our fire departments as socialist, which they are. And they don't think of our public roads as socialist, which they are. They don't even think of our government as having an appropriate function in the country because they've been listening to too much Ronald Reagan and the crazies from the Reich, the whole bunch of them. And they don't have an understanding of where this all began. Up until the 1630s, and I'm not going to go wonky on you, but this is so important to understand. Up until the 1630s, for 7,000 years of Western civilization, from the Epic of Gilgamesh 7,000 years ago in northern Iraq, in Uruk, until the 16th century, until the 17th century, the early 1600s, the prevailing assumption among people around the world was that people are fundamentally evil. It says so in the Bible, particularly women. Eve ate the apple, and so women have to be oppressed, and men have to be carefully controlled by a ruling aristocracy, and that ruling aristocracy is ordained by God. To this day, on the coins in the British Empire, you'll find four letters that translate to the Latin to she rules, or he rules in the case of a king. She rules by God's ordination or God's grace. God would pick the rulers. You had John Calvin, who came over here in the United States in the late 1700s, who spread his gospel in Europe and founded the Calvinist Church, saying, well, yeah, and the proof of who God likes is who's rich. Riches are proof of God's blessing, and therefore the rich people should rule the world. And in the book Leviathan in 1634, Thomas Hobbes laid this out. He was the very first one to establish the modern liberal worldview and the first to establish the modern conservative worldview at the same time. In the liberal worldview, he said people are capable of governing themselves. This was a radical idea. It led to the Revolution of 1635, the Revolution of 1665, the Revolution of 1668, the English Bill of Rights. I mean, the whole bit in 1667, the whole bit, it led to that. But he also said that the fundamental nature of people is evil. And because the fundamental nature of people is evil, we have to find among us those few good people, those few who have been blessed by God, and put them in charge. And the question is, how do you find them? And that's when John Calvin came along 60 years later and said, the way you find them is because they're rich. And we're still holding on to that to a large extent in the United States. Now, 50 years later, keep in mind, Hobbes was the tutor to, I forget my James and Charles, James the First and Charles the First, you know, one or the other. Hobbes was the tutor to one of them, and he impressed him upon this, and I'm pretty sure it was Charles. And he was followed by John Locke, who was the tutor to the other one. I think it was James. And Locke came along in his second treatise on government, which Thomas Jefferson stole from in writing the Declaration of Independence. Locke came along and said, no. People are fundamentally good. There are some evil people among us. There are some bad and twisted and damaged people among us, but people are fundamentally good. And the job of government is to transfer for as much power as possible to the people. And Locke, in his second treatise on government in 1758, came up with this phrase, the life, liberty, and estate, which is a fancy way of saying life, liberty, and private property. And 100 years later, when Thomas Jefferson, who was a child of the Enlightenment, who was a student of Locke and of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who 40 years later was looking at the noble savages, the Indians who were being brought over from North America and the people who were coming up from Africa. And he said, you know, they don't seem to be so unhappy. Life seems to be pretty good for them. And he came up with this idea of the noble savage. And Rousseau and Locke and Jefferson and Madison and Ben Franklin and George Washington, they say, no, there's something fundamentally good about humanity, and we need to invent a country. And this was the foundation of America, and this is how America is so completely different from every other country on the earth in the 1700s. We created a country where the majority of the people had the power, read the Constitution, rather than a king. And it took, you know, at the time of the Civil War, there were only six other nations that had adopted anything close to it. And during the Civil War, they all thought, that's it. The experiment's over. We're screwed. Now we've got 100 democratic countries in the world out of roughly 200 in the UN. So it has caught fire. And the problem is we've got a lot of people in the United States who don't understand that fundamental cleavage between the conservative worldview that people are evil and therefore we need a ruling elite and the liberal worldview, which says people are good and therefore we need to distribute power as widely as possible. Chris Matthews makes the joke. Republicans want a leader. Democrats want to have a meeting. He's right. And for good reason. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Armand in Florida. Hey, Armand, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing? Best teacher in the world.
I'm just great. What's up?
And I don't have to sit in some crappy wooden desk with fluorescent lights beaming at my brain.
Yeah, thank God. Neither do I.
Really? Amen.
School was no fun.
What's
on your mind, Armand?
I just want to say that there's an important point that the neocons don't bring up and the liberals don't bring up enough. And first, there's three important factors that I try to look at everything to analyze what's ensuing, what's reality, you know, what's the truth. And that is incentives, priorities, and economics, who wins and who loses. And the other profound point, I think, economically speaking, is the neocons and the liberals don't bring it up enough, is if you take the top 20% that effectively own and control all the debt, all the wealth, the money circulation, you know, too much. You and I both agree that's why we don't have a trickle, because it's a false premise that it trickles, because if it trickled, you know, the money would be circulating instead of bottled up like it is now. That's why we got to borrow from the people. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at the wealth of these people, the top 20%, my estimation is that probably 95% of that money originated from government spending and taxation.
Well, you could argue, Armin, that all of it did, because if we didn't have a good public school system, you'd have no wealth. If we didn't have a public road system, you wouldn't have any wealth. If you didn't have government establishing the corporate form so that you can go down and incorporate and have limited liability and have tax benefits, and you didn't have government enforcing contract law, and you didn't have courts enforcing, all of this is the commons. All of this is free, and we pay for it with our taxes. You wouldn't have that wealth. But when you say the top 20%, be careful. The top 20% is roughly people making over $100,000 a year. It's the top 1/10 of 1%, the people making over roughly $700,000 a year, $1 million a year. You know, there's only 144,000 people, more or less, in the United States who make over $1 million a year. We're talking about a very small segment who saw their income go up 800% during the Bush years, while the average working person saw their income go down 10%. I mean, you know, we really have to put things into perspective at some point. And thanks for the call, Armand. Stacy in Los Angeles. Hey, Stacy, you're on the air. Stacy? Stacy is not on the air.
Oh, no, I'm here. Here I am, Tom.
Okay, you're on the air, Stacy. What's up?
I'm sorry. I just want to make the observation with regard to your guest, Roger Simon, that I just don't buy his premise. I mean, Hollywood, of any industry, is only concerned about whether or not you're going to make money. If he wrote a great story, I guarantee you that somebody would make his story into a movie. They don't care if you're a pedophile, and nobody cares about your politics when it comes to making money.
Well,
I think the
agony of the Christ, or whatever the title of the movie was. I mean, there's been no shortage of shall we say conservative movies around. You know, although he would probably say that's the exception to the rule. But a good point, Stacy, and thank you for making it. Dan in Boston. Hey, Dan.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. You know, interestingly, we pay our taxes. We have very little choice over what our tax dollars are spent on. And in regards to public education, when public education was in its inception, was for people like you and I, Democrats who couldn't afford to send our kids to private school.
Yep.
And now you have Republicans who take advantage of that public education system. Does that mean that I have the choice to not subsidize their kids' education? No. I think it's for the common good.
Yeah, it makes me crazy, these guys who say, oh, I don't want to subsidize some guy who got a subprime mortgage, who got suckered in most cases. You know, 60% of all subprime mortgages were given to people who qualified for prime mortgages and were never told that. I mean, we're talking major fraud here. I don't want to subsidize them. Oh, you say, but, you know, you're willing to subsidize our public school system? You're willing to subsidize our police department, our fire department, even though you may never need it? Are you willing to subsidize that? There is an issue here of the commons. There is the issue.
My point. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome, Don. Dan, excuse me. There is an issue here that goes beyond the simple "we're all in this together," and that is the issue of what is the fundamental purpose of government. And the purpose of government in the United States is conceived by the founders when Jefferson wrote "Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Health." How can you have life if you don't have national health care? among other things. Liberty and the pursuit of happiness. How can you have the pursuit of happiness if you don't earn a living wage? If you're working 16 hours a day and you have no say in it, and you got to work 7 days a week starting at the age of 10, how can you have the pursuit of happiness? The six items that are listed in the preamble of the Constitution, well, I think one of the most important is the general welfare. The whole point of founding this country, the whole point of building it the way we built it, was to say not just that we're all in this together, but we're going to build an infrastructure. We're going to build a fertile soil in which business can grow, not toxic business, not multinational corporations like Hewlett-Packard that send all the jobs over to China, ship the stuff back, and then call themselves American companies, or Halliburton that goes off and reincorporates in Dubai, but real businesses to make a solid economy.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Fritz in Miami. Hey, Fritz, what's up?
Hello. I don't mean to go off topic, but I was listening to your show, and you were speaking about George Washington,
yep.
Thomas Jefferson. And I wanted to know, I read in an article that George Washington declined to become king of the United States because he was infertile. And I want to know, is that true?
Yes and no. He declined to become king of the United States. Alexander Hamilton, in his opening speech to the Constitutional Convention in August of 1787, proposed, and was booed down, by the way, but proposed that the office of the President of the United States should be a lifetime position. And at that time, it was broadly imagined that George Washington would be the guy who'd get it. It was bounced out because it seemed too much like a king. Hamilton was so offended he even left for a few months, although to his credit he came back, he finished the Constitution, he signed it, and he co-authored the Federalist Papers, which sold the Constitution along with James Madison and John Jay. But he was not offered a kingship, as it were. He simply was loudly opposed to the idea of rule forever. He also, at the end of his term, it was a shoo-in. He would have easily gotten another term as president, and he said, no, I'm not going to do this, thus establishing, at the end of his second term, thus establishing right up until Roosevelt the idea that a president didn't serve more than two terms, although Ulysses S. Grant wanted his party to nominate him for a third term, but he was so corrupted by the railroad scandals that his own Republican Party said no thanks, which, you know, in retrospect was probably a good thing. Art in Seattle. Hey, Art, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. First, I have to demolish the blacklist theory of Mr. Simon. Number one, he is a Republican. Otherwise, he wouldn't have used the word Islamo-fascist. Now about his theory, about all of the stars are none of the stars are Republicans anymore. Can mm-hmm. I mention John Malkovich, Heather Locklear, James Earl Jones, Mel Gibson, Robert Duvall, Kevin Costner, Jim Caviezel, James Caine, Jim Belushi, Chuck Norris, Regis Philbin, Dennis Quaid, The Rock, Adam Sandler, Gary Sinise, David Spade, Vince Vaughn, Bruce Willis, how about Fred Thompson, who's going back into television, Chuck Norris, Robert Duvall, Jeff Foxworthy. The theory that they're being blacklisted If they were any more whitelisted, I can't imagine how they could be doing business.
You did your homework better than me, Art. I appreciate the list. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Tom. Very well done. David in San Francisco. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I was also trying to get on with your previous guest. I, frankly, started calling up radio talk shows the evening of September 11th because of some real problems with it, and I feel somewhat responsible for the character change of America because I got up early to fight the lies, and I would have loved to challenge him. I guess I'll have to catch him on another show. Hey, I told you, Screener, there's a big, you know, the clean coal hoax. There's a big rally coming up in Washington, D.C. on March 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave her the website for it. It's capitalclimateaction.org. This is something that's sponsored by Sierra Club, any number of different Greenpeace. I think there are probably nearly 100, there are 100 and something actually endorsing organizations. And I wonder if you'll have a chance to get anybody as a guest. You know, this whole climate change model, the old boys have invested in bad ideas, bad inventions, and they refuse to take responsibility for the damages that they've caused. And they've, rather than clean up their wastes, they've gone out of their way to change the way universities are financed. They've gone out of their way to refuse to allow patents that make sense take effect. They've done everything they could do to crush the competition rather than allow the development of clean and alternative energy sources. You know, for the last 30 or 40 years, people have been trying to get clean and efficient transportation systems going, and these old boys have fought it every possible way they could.
Yeah, and now they're fighting it, and now they're fighting it with lies. David, once again, the URL?
Yeah, it's capitalclimateaction.org, and then capital with an O, so
as in the capital
be
of
at
the United States.
Nation's capital, right.
Okay.
So
David,
if you get a chance to get somebody as a guest, that'd be great.
Thank you very much. Our producer, Sean Taylor, is listening, so we'll see what happens on that. And by the way, thisisreality.org is another great site if you want to know, you know, what's going on with so-called clean coal, because it's a hoax. It's just pure and simple, it's a hoax. There ain't no such thing. Back, I don't know, 20 years ago or so, when I was CEO of an advertising agency in Atlanta, and one of our clients, among others, was American Express, I discovered that American Express had spent more money, and this isn't like, you know, I'm not dissing them for this. This is just common sense, actually. They spent more money advertising the fact that if your traveler's checks got stolen, they would refund them, then they did refunding traveler's checks. And, you know, of course, because you want, you know, it's actually kind of a good thing on American Express that, you know, not a lot of traveler's checks got stolen, so they didn't have to do a lot of refunds, and the fact that they would refund it was a good sales point. But it almost seems, and I have no idea what the numbers are. I'm sure they're a very, very closely kept secret. But I wonder how much money clean coal is, or the coal industry is spending, or the toxic fossil fuel industry as a whole, from buying spokespeople, co-opting politicians, lobbying, running advertising, sponsoring the presidential debates, remember that, versus how much money they're trying to spend for carbon sequestration.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club. Providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
To the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Carrie Lucas on the line. She's the Vice President of Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF, Michelle Bernard, her erstwhile companion and boss, I guess. Hey, Carrie, welcome back.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
Always a pleasure talking with you. Actually, it was James Toronto, I guess, posting over at the IWF.org, the new federalism now and wife beheading, an issue for the state. Instead of, you know, tell us what's going on here. Here we have this tragic case of this guy, this couple, and apparently this was this guy's third wife, who came from Pakistan to the United States to start a TV network to dispel the stereotypes of Muslims, and his wife decides to divorce him, and in a rage, he cuts her head off. You take it from there.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And actually, this is one of those times, you know, usually I'm coming on and complaining about some of the differences I have with groups like the National Organization for Women. But this is actually an instance where I applaud what the New York Now chapter did. And it was trying to raise more awareness about this case, because I think that this is just a horrifying instance, obviously, of domestic or of violence against women. It's really, to call it domestic violence is almost, you know, inappropriate. It doesn't take it far enough. This is a, you know, obviously a hideous murder. But a lot of the media, it hasn't received as much attention as you might expect. It was buried in a lot of the New York papers had it, you know, way back in their news stories. It wasn't given much coverage. And the National Organization for Women now in New York brought up this point: is it, have we become so uncomfortable with the idea of talking about anything that could be considered anti-Muslim or to be impugning the Muslim faith, that we are now ignoring situations like this, where we all, as a world, need to come out and say, you know, this is inappropriate, and some of the treatment of women that women are regularly subjected to is needs to be stopped, regardless of where it's happening.
Amen. Now, here's the problem that I have. First of all, I've noticed a bunch of conservative sites are trashing the National Organization of Women. And in fact, this article over at IWF does, for not taking a similar stand and for calling it murder. And there's a reality here that in many countries, and this is not limited to the Islamic world. I've spent a lot of time in India. And I'll tell you, you know, honor killings are very common, particularly in rural India to this day, and that's a Hindu nation. You find the same thing in South America, Catholic nations. It's not unusual to have honor killings. They typically don't behead, or at least expulsions from the family. I mean, just horrible things. Basically, women, particularly girls, are considered the property of their families or of their fathers, and this whole patriarchy. What I hear from the conservative side, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong on this, because that's your side there, is that this, oh boy, a great opportunity to trash Islam. And I don't think that this is a problem with Islam. I think that this is a problem of culture. Here's a guy who came over here to try to elevate his culture, and yet culture was so deeply entrenched in him. It was so much a part of him that he beheads his wife. I mean, this, if you want to solve this kind of problem, why don't we go to the James Morgenson solution, Three Cups of Tea, the book that he wrote, where, you know, he was climbing Mount Everest and he got stuck and he was nurtured back to health in this little country in Afghanistan, or in Pakistan rather, and he's built something like 60 schools now, and as a consequence, because he's educating the girls, the local people have thrown out the Taliban. This is how you change a culture. I would suggest that those elements of Islamic culture that treat women like the property of their husbands or fathers, those elements of Hindu culture, those elements of South American Catholic culture, or for that matter in the United States of America, where you have around an 8 or 9% spousal abuse rate in the United States, that those elements of that culture are still living in the 9th or 10th century.
Sure, and yeah, absolutely. And this isn't—I don't think this is an Islam problem. Although I think that what is important is that we aren't afraid to talk about this. Is in Islamic nations, it's not the same as, you know, yes, we have continue to have spousal abuse problems here in the United States, but I don't think that anybody would compare the situation that women today face in the United States to that that's faced in many of the Arab and predominantly Muslim nations throughout the world. And we do have to stand up and say, this isn't acceptable. This isn't, it's not a proper part of Islam. This shouldn't be. Honor killings have no place in any culture, and really have to begin talking about that.
But period has, my point is it has nothing to do, I agree with you. My point is, though, that, or actually I disagree with you. My point is that it has nothing to do with the religion. There's nothing in Islam that says that this is appropriate, just like there's nothing in Hinduism that says this is appropriate, just like there's nothing in Catholicism or Protestantism or Judaism or any of the other world's religions where we have seen these kinds of things happen for thousands of years, Eve eating the apple, which was used as a justification for it for a long time. I'd say this is a cultural problem.
But I do think that it's also worth acknowledging that there is a strain of Islam that today does think this is appropriate, and that increasingly, even in places like Britain, that there is a growing tolerance for schools that are based on a very radical, what most moderate mainstream Islam would consider a false version of Islam, and that this is something that as Westerners we should be, and as people who believe in freedom of speech, that we can't shy away from saying, like, no, this is inappropriate. You think about what happened.
No.
Some conservatives have tied together the decision in Britain to decide against letting a Dutch parliamentarian who'd written a very provocative or produced a very provocative movie criticizing Islam, that he had been invited to speak at the I believe it was the House of Lords, and then was disinvited because there was this fear of unrest. And I think that a lot of people said, you know, I don't know enough about this guy's movie to know if it's appropriate or if it goes too far. But as a culture that values freedom of speech, we can't let people we can't let the fear of offending someone.
Banned Fred Phelps from either Germany or England last week. The guy who runs around with the posters "God hates fags." He's misinterpreted it, by the way. It's "God hates figs." Four different places in the Bible, three different places in the New Testament, once in the Old Testament, God cursed a fig tree. Jesus did three times, and in Isaiah did once, and the fig tree withered. God actually hates figs. There's no reference in the Bible to "God hates fags." So, he got it wrong. But Fred Phelps and his Westboro Baptist Church have been banned as well. And in the United States, if the president of the KKK wanted to address Congress, I think we'd say, you know, no, thank you. But my point is, and I wrote a piece for give me a reality check on this, Kerry. Back after 9/11, I was invited by Rodale Press, along with a bunch of other folks. There was about 30 of us all together. The Pope John Paul II, Billy Graham, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Those were the big names. And then there were, Rabbi Michael Lerner and myself and a few other people to write an article about what happened at 9/11 and the significance. And the point that I made is that Christianity went through a reformation after the Crusades in the 15th and 16th century with Luther, and essentially moved into the modern era and left that kind of thing behind, because mercy killings were a big part of Christianity in the 12th century. Judaism went through that reformation arguably 2,000 years ago. Hinduism has been slowly going through it over the last 1,000 years, the last few hundred years anyway. Much of modern Islam has been going through that. Women don't wear the headscarf, or at least didn't until recently in large parts of Iran. And before we threw Saddam out of Iraq, women were doctors, they were professors, they were teachers. There were basically no barriers. They were bureaucrats. Now, of course, they're moving back. My point is that these people are living in the 10th century rather than the 21st century, and we need to reach out to them at a cultural level rather than demonizing their religion. The more we demonize the religion, the more we polarize them, and the more we make them the way that we're saying they are.
Well, you know, I think that there's some truth to that, and I think that we do need to make sure, and I think that President Bush certainly went through great pains to make sure that, as he always spoke about the true religion, Islam, as a religion of peace. But I don't think we can pretend that there isn't a strain out there that is very hostile and is very abusive of or often very.
But there is in Christianity too. I mean, look at the modern day Church of the Latter Day Saints, or whatever they call it, the FLDS.
You're going to compare Mormonism to jihadist Islamists.
I'll bet you, Kerry, that out of the billion Muslims in the United States, the percentage of Muslims who are the crazies is about the same as the percentage of Mormons who are FLDS versus the traditional Mormon Church.
In the United States is a very different circumstance. We need to have this message around the world that this cannot be tolerated.
I agree. Although we need to take it a step further. We need to empower women. We need to teach girls. We need to give equal access and equal rights to women and equal power to them around the world. You agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Okay. Carrie Lucas. IWF.org, the International, International Women's Forum. Thanks, Carrie.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Okay, there are a lot of conservatives who will immediately agree with the proposition women shouldn't be the property of men, they shouldn't be beheaded. Yeah, sounds good. And how can you disagree with that? But here's the larger issue. Here's the bigger picture. And let me frame this let's strip the morality out of it for a moment, because that can get very confusing. In the real world, it's impossible altogether to strip the morality out. But let's just look at this from a practical point of view. The population of this planet at the time that Jesus was running around loose was a quarter of a billion, 250 million people. For the 165,000 years before that, the population of the planet varied from around 50 million humans to around 250 million. It slowly rose up to it. It was up until the agricultural revolution around 10,000 years ago, it was around 50, 60 million people, period, worldwide. Time of Jesus, it was a quarter of a billion. Now, the world was not unpopulated at that time. North America was so populated that Native American tribes had come into conflict with each other over land. The world was well populated all over, everywhere. But nonetheless, a quarter of a billion people. We hit our first billion people in 1800. Our second billion took only 130 years, 1930. The third billion took only 30 years, 1960. The fourth billion took only 14 years, 1987. The fifth billion took only 13 years, 1987, the fifth billion. The sixth billion took only 11 years, 1999. Now, there are people who claim that what is driving that population explosion and all the wars that go with it and all the pollution that goes with it and all the violence against women that goes with it, that what is driving that is economics. You get the World Bank out there saying, well, if everybody just lived at the standard of living of America and Sweden, which have zero population growth outside of immigration, then everything would be fine. Well, if the world lived at the Appalachian family of four's income, poverty level, $14,200 a year for a family of four, it would take four planet Earths to provide the natural materials, the raw materials. Not possible with 6 going on 7 billion people. Besides that, there are countries in the Middle East where people get $42,000 a year simply for being a citizen from oil revenue, and they still have 11 kids. So, no, it's not economic. As much as the World Bank and the IMF and everybody from Bill Clinton to George W. Bush and the Reaganites would like to have you believe that, and therefore we should have globalism and a world run by the big corporations, that ain't going to do it. On the other hand, by the way, very poor tribes, indigenous people all around the world, have zero population growth and have for 20, 30, 40,000 years. So that's not it. It's not money. Then there are those who say it's technology. If you just had enough birth control pills, we have a shortage of birth control pills in the world. If we just had enough birth control pills for everybody on the planet, everything would be fine. Well, the fact of the matter is, according to Planned Parenthood, there are about 700 million families that wish they had access to birth control but don't. But that's not enough to add a billion people to the planet every 11 years. That's not the cause of this explosion in population. So what is it? When you look, what you find is there is one single variable that contributes to population. The proof of this is that those numbers of the population explosion I just gave you are not of all humans. They're just of our culture. Our culture being the culture that uses technology, that uses tools, and that uses sophisticated tools and that uses alphabets, whether it's in China or whether it's in the United States. The fact of the matter is that there are thousands of Aboriginal and Indigenous people around the world whose populations have been stable for thousands or tens of thousands of years. Now, what makes the difference? The difference is very simple. In those cultures where women have relatively equal power with men, population explosion, population growth goes to zero. In those populations, in those cultures where women are the property of men, population explodes. It's just that simple. So if we want to, you know, looking at this horrible beheading as a symptom of a larger cause, that larger cause is not just a religion, because Islam doesn't explicitly say women are the, or you could argue that it does say that women are the problem. Just like in Christianity, in Romans, Paul says, or in Corinthians rather, Paul says that a woman should be quiet and keep her head covered when she's in church. She shouldn't speak up to her husband. He's the head of the family, all that. I mean, you could argue that this is in our religions, but we've gone beyond that, many of us. This is my point about the 10th and the 21st century. We need to come into the 21st century, and our job, if we really want there to be no more beheadings of women in the Muslim world, our job should be to be building schools for girls in Pakistan, building schools for girls in Afghanistan, working for the rights of women around the world. That's the true human rights movement. That is going to solve, in large part, or at least address, everything from the pollution problem to the violence against women problem to the population problem and all the things attendant to it, peak oil, you add it all together. That is the thing. That is the core. That's the key to the whole thing. Our job, if you want the most powerful lever, the trim tab that will turn the ship, that's it. Empower women. And not in a gratuitous way, not in a cheap soundbite way, not just, oh, let's condemn this guy, he beheaded his wife. Oh, let's condemn Islam, they don't let you know. No, that's not the case. That's not how you do it. Give them knowledge, give them information, and change the culture so women are seen as the same as men at the level of power.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
The price of gold is rising out of sight, and the dollar is in sorry shape tonight. What the dollar used to get us now won't get ahead and let us know the economic forecast isn't right. But amidst the clouds I spot a shining ray. I begin to glimpse a new and better way. I devised a plan of action, worked it down to the last fraction, and I'm going into action here today. I am changing my name to Chrysler. I am going down to Washington, D.C. I will tell some power broker what you did for Iacocca would be perfectly acceptable to me. I am changing my name to Chrysler.
Yeah, let's change our name to Bank of America. Or Citibank or something like that. Oh, man, downright crazy stuff going on in the world, I tell you. Downright strange. Remember the guy who owned the hardware store in Dallas? Elliott's Hardware? Andrea Bond, actually. I guess a woman rather than a man who offered George W. Bush a job. Said, hey, he's out of a job. He can come to work here as a greeter. Well, last week, George W. Bush showed up at the store. Actually, this is kind of a pro-Bush story, I guess. He walked up to her and he says, I'm looking for a job. What can I say? Maybe there is some humanity to this guy. Anyhow, he spent an hour shopping, talking to customers during the surprise visit, bought a few flashlights, batteries, and a can of WD-40, some night lights. He and his wife, Laura, moved into a home in the Preston Hollow area of Dallas, an area that less than a decade ago, it was illegal to live in if you were an African-American. So, anyhow, Bush moving on up in the world. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Peter in Columbia, South Carolina. You want to disagree with me, you go to the front of the line. What's up, Peter? Hey, Peter.
Yeah.
Peter?
Yeah, can you hear me?
You're on the air.
Forget it. Yeah, well, listen, I think, first off, what you're saying, you're presenting it like it's a theory, and of course there's no scientific data or basis for anything you're saying. You're saying, well, there's this one variable, and there's no science behind any of that.
Actually, there's an enormous amount of science behind it.
Actually, there's not, and you'd quote it if there was. But let's put this in perspective, okay? And I would say in America, I don't think we have perfect equality between men and women.
No, we don't.
But we're certainly better than, say, Saudi Arabia, let's say, or Afghanistan. But nonetheless, we have Octomom, right? We have all these unwed mothers.
Peter, that woman is mentally ill. She's no representative of womanhood in the United States.
No, she's a representative of a lot of these teenagers that were up in Guam.
No, she's not.
15-year-old girls.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's over the top. This is a woman who is suffering from some variation of obsessive compulsive disorder. She's like a collector. She's like those people who have 35 years worth of newspapers. She's like the women who have 35 cats and some men who have 350 cats in their house. I mean, there is something fundamentally wrong there, and it's a tragedy. Jim in Boca Raton, California. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, I have one small issue, and before I say anything, I'm a very liberal. I vote Democrat, and I was raised Christian and don't really ascribe to all that. But when you spoke about the difference between Mohammedism or Islam and Christianity, and I hear this from a lot of people, the biggest difference that I see is that the two founders of the religion had completely different ideas about violence. That if Jesus saw what all the people who did things in his name were doing, he would have said, "What are you doing?" Whereas that cannot be said for Muhammad, because he actually conquered Medina.
Yeah.
He spread his religion through violence. Now, that does not mean that the pillars of Islam are wrong, and it has many, many good attributes. Nonetheless, Jesus was much more like Buddha, and you could almost compare Muhammad much more to Aaron and Moses, who spread their religion through warlike violence.
But, Jim, if you go back read Exodus or I mean, there are a number of books in the Bible.
Yes.
That, where I think it was in Elijah. No, it wasn't Elijah. I'm forgetting which book it was in, where God commanded his servant, the guy who was the hero of the book, to go into the city of Ai and kill every living person, including cutting open the bellies of the pregnant women and cutting the dogs open and killing, literally killing everything. Joshua is the book of Joshua.
Joshua, right,
And kill everybody. And take the king of the head of the king and put it on a stake out in front of the city, and things like that. I mean, you can argue that the David was a warrior, who took on Samson or took on Goliath. You could argue that the foundations of many of our religions. You go back to the story of Arjuna, the assistant to the warlord of Islam. The founders of many of our religions were not peaceful people, shall we say.
But not Jesus, though, and not
Jesus,
Buddha.
And Buddha. Uniquely, I agree with you. Uniquely, Jesus and Buddha were mystics, and yet their message got corrupted into a warlike message for at least Jesus's did.
Well, that's because we don't practice Christianity today. We practice Paulinism.
I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. But rather than, micro-criticizing or critiquing the individual religions, let's look at the culture that surrounds them and out of which they grow. You could argue that 1,000 years ago, the tribe that had the largest number of kids was the tribe that had the largest army. That's where I said take the morality
true.
Out of it. And
very
therefore,
true.
They're the ones that had the greatest probability of survival. You and I are the descendants of the tribe that had the largest number of kids. The
and
tribe that,
that
didn't have the largest
the
number of kids. Let me just finish the sentence. The tribe that didn't have the largest number of kids got wiped out, and they don't have any descendants. Now that was a value,
mentality.
Right? Well, it's actually an early mentality when humans were first starting to populate the earth in significant ways, and resources were scarce. That is no longer the case, and that mentality is no longer useful, and that's why we call it immoral now. And what we need to do is
that's
spread.
That's a subjective term.
Well, that's my point, that it was moral at one point, and it's immoral now.
It,
that if you wanted to be the religion that had the greatest number of people. I mean, here you've got a million Muslims, you've got a million Catholics. If you want to be the religion that has, or billion rather, if you want to be the religion that has the greatest number of people, what you do is you suppress women.
Well,
you turn them into cows. It's fascinating to go back and read, for all practical purposes, and I'm using the phrase of the Native Americans when Brainerd and some of the early folks who first met with the Native American tribes. Jefferson writes about this at some length in his private diary, and it's really well worth reading, how among the Iroquois, they considered it very bad form for a woman to have a baby more than every seven years, and they did not practice infanticide. And he said that they knew which herbs were abortifacients or which herbs prevented pregnancy, and they also knew how to have sex in ways that didn't cause pregnancy. In other words, they were either familiar with the rhythm method or they were practicing, you know, non-vaginal sex.
Well,
and,
you see a correlation? Don't you see a correlation, though, between the socioeconomic level of people and their, A, need for some kind of savior religion, and, B, their need to surround themselves with children who will provide for them? I mean, they go hand in hand. Once you get out of that lower socioeconomic...
With A, yes. With B, it's a cultural thing. And so the more that we can do, you know, obviously the more that we can do to lift people out of just absolutely abject poverty, then you can talk to them. You know, this is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. People are concerned about safety and survival and homeostasis long before they're concerned about community and friendship and individual relationships and enlightenment and everything else. And so, you know, obviously we have an obligation, as it were, to this is where I said, you know, build schools, build hospitals. People say, you know, why did the Palestinians vote for Hamas? They voted for Hamas because Hamas was building the schools and the hospitals. Hamas was providing the old age pensions. Hamas was distributing oil, cooking oil. When they are below the threshold, below Maslow's threshold, and this is the essence, by the way, of the book that I've got coming out this summer called Threshold, The Crisis of Western Culture. When they're below that threshold, democracy is impossible, and egalitarianism is impossible, because they will go with the strong man, they will go with the dictator. When you get above that threshold, then democracy is not only probable, but you know, typically is the outcome.
It's $8,000, right? Isn't it about $8,000 per year that they need to hit in order for democracy to stick, and below five, they don't?
It depends on the country. It depends on what the local resources are. It depends on the lifestyle. You could argue that it was dramatically lower than that, even in today's dollars, 150 years ago, when 60-70% of Americans were family farmers, and they grew most of what they consumed. It really varies from person to person. But my point is that rather than just looking at the founders of the religions, we need to take a little larger view and a little more abstract view and say we need to be making cultural views. We need to bring people into the modern day. Matt in Seattle, just a minute before the break here. Matt, what's up?
All right. Well, Jim stole my thunder, but I can agree that our approach to the suppression of women needs to be broader than just attacking Islam. But I think it's extremely dishonest to say that the oppressive interpretation is extremist. I think after you spend 5 minutes flipping through the Quran, it's easy, I think, to determine that the Islamic religion, just based on the text itself, without any effort put into interpretation, plays as much or more of a role than any other cultural factor.
But I would say that you could say the same is true of Judaism and Christianity, which is why historically they've oppressed women. I mean, the lineage of Jesus in Matthew doesn't mention a single woman. You go back to Genesis, and who was it who was the source of all original sin, the reason why we all suffer, why men toil at the field? Eve, you know, women are the... We need to go beyond that. These were useful creation myths and useful myths when the goal of a culture was to produce as many warriors as possible. They're not useful myths anymore. We have to replace them.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Shattered, left in pieces like it never even mattered. There's lie still. Cigarette smoking on a windowsill. There's a picture locked up in an old suitcase. Billy closes his eyes, but he still sees her face. Broke down, cracked dead and shattered, left in pieces like it never.
9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day, by the way, from George Carlin, the reason they call it the American Dream is because you have to be asleep to believe in it. But just a quick update on my travel plans. Thursday and Friday this week, I'll be at the Conservative Political Action Conference. It's always a hoot. It's one of my favorite parts of the year. We've been doing it for 4 years now. CPAC in Washington, D.C. We will be shoveling to you nonstop right-wing crazies one after another for three straight hours, and it makes them very entertaining radio. On the 7th of March, on Saturday, in Seattle, we have our three-hour cruise with KTPK AM Talk 1090. Louise and I will be there. Information at am1090seattle.com. March 19th in Chicago, I'm debating Michael Medved. You can get tickets for that. And please show up. We need you cheering for the group. All of the funds go to support the radio station, not for me. Chicago's... that's plural, progressive talk, chicagosprogressivetalk.com. And on May 2nd, I'll be in Denver, Colorado for the Green Festival in Colorado. I'm keynoting that conference, greenfestivals.org/Denver. And those are always a hoot. Typically, you know, a couple thousand people show up. They're a lot of fun. Kate in Salem, Oregon. Kate, before Victoria Jones does our news, I just wanted to get you in with a quick comment. You're on the air.
Oh, I want to tell you how wonderful it is to listen to you expound on the status of women. I would love for you to do a book on it.
I have.
What is it? Tell me quick.
It's titled Threshold, and it's coming out in July.
I want the first copy. And okay. Then I have a quote for you.
Okay.
I believe from Benjamin Franklin, who said, you educate a man, you educate a person, you educate a woman, and you educate a family.
Wow, that's brilliant. Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care and keep up the good work.
You too. I appreciate the call. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, Talk Radio News in Washington, D.C., our accredited White House reporter, Pentagon reporter, congressional reporter, U.N. reporter. You got all kinds of badges to hang around your neck, don't you, Victoria?
Yes, I have. And some of the badges you mentioned are ones that I genuinely do have, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's going on in the world?
Well, at the White House today is the Fiscal Responsibility Summit. 130 luminaries from all sorts of different organizations, the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, Families USA, AFSCME, you name it, they were here to talk about fiscal responsibility, to talk about health care reform, the tax code, all kinds of different aspects of fiscal responsibility. The president addressed them. They broke into breakout groups where they could really talk about their particular issues, their passions, and it's something that can either be a photo op or it can be meaningful, and which one it is, we don't know yet. Whether it's going to have any kind of meaningful outcome, it's hard to tell at this point. But the president wanted it to have a meaningful outcome. There are some who were a little skeptical of it, but he made the effort to have this event, and he gave remarks and said that he had inherited this enormous deficit, and made it very clear that this was a deficit that he had inherited, and talked about how he is committed to reducing it by half by the end of his first term. And we're going to hear a good bit more about that, of course, in his remarks to a joint session of Congress tomorrow night, and we'll hear more about it when he unwraps his budget on Thursday.
Several of those groups you named, Victoria, are famously and proudly conservative in as much as they think that things like health care are not part of the commons. They're gung-ho for the military, it seems, but welfare, taking care of people who are not able to work or not part of the commons. The government should not be the employer of last resort. The government should not be involved in education. Education is not part of the commons. They have views that at least those of us who voted for Obama figured were in contrast to his. To what extent do you think that this is really a listening and understanding term gig versus a PR event?
I think that's an impossible question to answer.
Well, let me rephrase it then. How much influence do you think the right-wingers are going to have on the Obama administration?
I think that they will not have as much influence as you, for example, might be concerned about. I think Obama is a man of his own mind, and I think he has strong opinions on these things. I think he also has an awful lot of input from his own fiscal people, from Geithner, from Summers, and you may have concerns about what their particular bias is, but I think he'll get a lot of input from them.
Yeah, well, Geithner and Summers in particular are the two people about whom I'm most concerned in the Obama administration. I think that they're I don't think that they're what he needs. I don't, if he's going to go down a Franklin Roosevelt path and bring this country back to prosperity, I don't think that they're going to take it. And the murmuring that we're hearing about, let's keep rendering, extraordinary renditions going, and let's not prosecute the Bush administration and stuff like that. It's spooking me.
Speaking of that, just very briefly, before I get on to something else very interesting that's going on today, they have until Wednesday to decide what to do on executive privilege. Federal appeals court has given them just until Wednesday to decide whether to support President Bush's use of executive privilege in the case of whether Karl Rove is going to have to testify.
What's the significance of that?
Well, they would like to be able to sit on the sidelines and not have to take a position. But John Conyers, Representative John Conyers, has called Karl Rove to testify before his committee.
Right.
And basically, the administration has got sucked into this and is going to have to decide one way or the other, are they backing Bush's executive privilege or are they not backing Bush's executive privilege on this?
But they, their opinion will become irrelevant until or unless the whole Senate votes a contempt citation, right?
I'm not sure about that.
Because at that point, it would be up to the Justice Department to enforce the contempt citation because of that deal that was made back during the Johnson administration or whenever it was when Congress stopped enforcing their own contempt citations. Well, we'll see how it shakes out.
Indeed. Yeah.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thank you very much for the...
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club. Providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, this is an interesting one. The Center for American Progress is reporting over at thinkprogress.org. Pursuant to a subpoena issued earlier this month, Karl Rove was due to appear for a hearing before the House Judiciary Committee today. But as Congress Matters reports, despite being expected to appear this time, Rove was a no-show. Contacted by Think Progress, the House Judiciary Committee confirmed the report of Rove's absence. Days before leaving office, Bush's White House counsel Fred Fielding had sent letters to Rove, Myers, and Bolton instructing them to continue to ignore congressional demands for information about anything they did while at the White House. Yes, they are criminals. They know they are criminals. They know that if they had to testify under oath about the crimes that they are accused of, that Karl Rove would find his ass in jail as quickly as he put Don Siegelman in jail. Consider the case of Don Siegelman. He beat Bill Riley in the race for governor of Alabama by just a few thousand votes, by about 3,000 votes. Went to sleep thinking that he was reelected as governor, the Democrat. Don Siegelman, two-term Democratic governor. In the middle of the night, in the most Republican district in the state, the chairman of the Republican Party in that district had sole control over the vote counting computer and discovered on that computer, this guy who is not a computer expert, discovered on that computer 15,000 votes that had been overlooked. And so in the morning when Don Siegelman woke up, he was behind Bob Riley instead of ahead. He was no longer the governor of Alabama. When he tried to protest this, the right-wing talk machine all across Alabama, and there's a very healthy one, as there is in virtually every state in this union, particularly in the red states, the right-wing talk machine went into full bloviation mode. Oh, he's just a whiner. Look at that guy. He's whining. He's complaining. Why doesn't he take his medicine like a man? He lost. He used to. It was the same thing that they did to Al Gore in 2000. They thought they were rid of him. So he starts organizing a political comeback. And it looks like he's going to make it. He was one of the most popular governors in the history of Alabama. So Karl Rove's best friend for 35 years, old college buddy of Karl Rove's, Bill Canary, his wife, Laura, gets appointed by Gonzalez, I believe, as federal prosecutor for that district. Now, Bill Canary was the campaign manager for Mr. Riley, the guy that Siegelman beat. When Siegelman had been governor, he had appointed a fellow who had been on the board that oversaw the behavior of hospitals in the state of Alabama. This was an unpaid position. It was not one of those things where you can make some money at it. And the guy had been appointed to that board by the two previous Republican governors. He had served three terms on that board. But Laura Canary, the wife of the campaign manager of the guy that Don Siegelman beat and was fixing to beat in the next election, prosecuted him, saying that appointing this guy to this board. This guy was a fairly wealthy guy, which is why he was able to serve on philanthropic boards like overseeing hospitals where there was no money to be made, and he didn't have a dog in the fight, he didn't have a business that he was promoting, anything like that. At the same time all this was going on, there was a campaign in the state led by Jack Abramoff to make it illegal for anybody other than Indian tribes to have casinos in the state. In other words, they did not want to have a lottery. They did not want there to be a state lottery. Jack Abramoff had taken, and Ralph Reed had taken millions of dollars from the Indian tribes to prevent a lottery from happening in Alabama. When he was governor, Don Siegelman wanted there to be a lottery. He thought it could be used to fund the schools, as it is in many states around the country. So this guy made a $500,000 contribution, not to Don Siegelman, not to his campaign committee, not to anything that he had any control over, but to the independent nonprofit that was arguing in favor of a lottery commission. This guy makes a $500,000 contribution to it. Says this is a good idea. It'll help education in this state. Laura Canary goes into court, and later she recused herself and her surrogate finished the job, but she initiated it, goes into court and says, this guy gave a $500,000 donation to a group that Don Siegelman agreed with. And then Don Siegelman appointed him to the same hospital commission that the two previous Republicans had appointed him to. Therefore, Don Siegelman is guilty of a felony. The jury was given such narrow instructions by the judge that all 50 states' attorney general in the United States said this was a travesty. This judge rigged the jury outcome because the jury has to do what the judge says. And the judge said, basically, if you agree that this lottery commission was something that the governor was in favor of, and if you agree that the governor appointed this guy to the hospital board, then he's guilty of a crime. A crime that, by the way, happens all across the United States all the time. but it's never viewed as a crime anywhere else. So Don Siegelman shows up in court. The jury says, yep, according to the instructions of the judge, he's guilty. They put him in handcuffs and shackle his ankles together. He says, wait a minute, don't I get appeal? Can't I post bail on appeal? I'm not a flight risk. I'm not a murderer. Nope, you can't do that. They take him off to a maximum security prison and put him in solitary confinement so that he can't talk to the press for over a year. And who engineered this thing? Karl Rove is the best guess of everybody involved. Karl Rove destroyed this guy, man's life. Don Siegelman's now hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt for his legal bills. You can see the whole story. You can read the whole story over at donsiegelman.com, I before E. And this was just one example, by the way. Paul Miner, another. This is just one example of the people whose lives Karl Rove destroyed, Karl Rove and his buddies. If there is any truth at all to this story, and it appears fairly overwhelming, and all this congressional committee wants to do is ask the question, any truth to this? Karl Rove should be the one who is in ankle shackles and bracelets and handcuffs, led off to a maximum security federal prison. If there ever was a time to call your member of the House of Representatives, you can go to callcongress.org. There's all the toll-free numbers there, as well as the four-toll number. If you've got one of these phones where, you know, it doesn't cost you anything to make a long-distance call. A lot of folks with cell phones do. You got a certain number of minutes every year. You got unlimited minutes or whatever. Just call the regular 212 number. If there was ever a time to call your member of Congress and say, Karl Rove just thumbed his nose at Congress, he should not get away with this. I am infuriated. Hold Karl Rove in contempt of Congress. Because, see, what's going to happen is the committee will hold him in contempt, and then it goes before the entire House. And every single member of the House of Representatives has to vote on this. And if they vote to hold him in contempt, then it goes to the White House. Then it goes to the Department of Justice, because the deal that was made 50 years ago, more or less, as I recall, was that the judiciary branch would give up its police functions. The sergeant at arms would be more of a ceremonial post. And the Justice Department would agree to always enforce the subpoenas and always enforce the contempt proceedings of the House of Representatives, even though technically that's a violation of the separation of powers in the Constitution. So then it's going to go to Eric Holder. And then we need to be calling Eric Holder's office and saying, okay, the Congress has voted contempt for Karl Rove, throw his ass in jail. But first, we have to get every single member of the House of Representatives on the phone and say, this man is in contempt of Congress. Push it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Your radio support group for We the People of the United States of America, and frankly, all life on Earth. If we don't start extending it to that, we're all screwed. Doug Cunningham is with us. He is the producer of Workers Independent News, the website laborradio.org. Hey, Doug, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks for giving workers a voice on your program.
My honor. So, what's going on in the world of labor?
Big automotive news in the auto industry. Today, the UAW this morning announced an agreement with Ford Motor Company on a deal for their retiree health care fund, which is a huge deal. There are hundreds of thousands of retirees depending on this, and the UAW has reached an agreement with Ford. It's a concessionary deal, essentially, but it allows Ford to use stock for half of the money that they're going to put into this VEBA. The reason this is so important is because the auto industry is restructuring. It's gotten those billions of dollars in government loans, so it has to cut its costs. And it agreed back in 2007 to set up this healthcare trust fund and pump $46.1 billion into it, all three of the Detroit Three automakers, in exchange for getting rid of $88 billion in estimated future healthcare costs. So it's a very big deal for the auto industry, and since the auto industry is so critical to the country, it's a big deal for the country, too.
So this is good news?
Well, you know, it's risky news. It's good news that the UAW thinks it's gotten an agreement which it says will protect UAW jobs going forward because it will help make these automakers more viable. But as everybody knows, with all the stock volatility and the financial crisis, they're depending on this stock now to fund future retiree health care. And that's a big change because up to this point, the auto companies had to put cash into this trust fund. Now it's a mixture of cash and stock. And the UAW still has to get an agreement with General Motors, which has the largest number of retirees. That's 900,000 retirees and spouses at GM dependent on this health care. They still have to reach an agreement with them and with Chrysler. And there's a March 31st government deadline to convince the government that all of these ducks are in a row to make the auto industry viable again. And it's not just auto workers. I mean, if people think that it's just auto workers being affected by these deals, they're wrong. As many as 3 million jobs in this country could vanish in a hurry if one of these Detroit Three automakers goes bankrupt. So yeah, That's one of the reasons it's so important to the country at large.
What else is going on?
Well, you know, we have the Employee Free Choice Act is on the immediate horizon. We have the Senate leader, Harry Reid, saying that the Employee Free Choice Act, they could act on it as soon as this summer in Congress. That's a huge labor law reform. That's the biggest and most important labor law reform in generations. And it would set the stage for a revitalization of the labor movement if it is, in fact, passed. President Obama said he supported it when he was on the campaign trail. And it got a majority in the House, and they supported it, but the Senate, it stalled in the Senate, essentially, last time around. So this is a very important battle, and big business is going to fight this tooth and nail. They're going to spend an estimated $200 million against it. What it does is it allows workers to choose how they're going to form a union. They can form a union simply by signing cards that are government-certified union cards, and then the employers would have to recognize them. Right now, the employers can decide to force the workers into an election. And they rig the game and play the election against the workers by trying to intimidate, coerce, and scare them out of their legal right to join a union. So this is a huge deal. It's at the top of the labor agenda. And it'd be fair to say it's at the top of big business's agenda to defeat this thing.
You betcha. I have a question about that, Doug, about the politics of it. I heard an anti-Employee Free Choice Act ad the other day, one of these ads sponsored by the Better Business Group or Chamber of Commerce or whoever it is.
Oh, yeah.
And they had George McGovern on, and he said, this legislation would forbid, and I'm pretty sure he used the word forbid or make illegal or words to that effect, a private vote on whether or not a group wanted to have a union. And my understanding was that the Employee Free Choice Act says we're adding something, we're not taking something away. In other words, not only can you have the private vote as it is now, but in addition, if you don't want to do that, you can just have more than 51% of the people sign a card. Was McGovern telling the truth in that? And if not, was he misinformed? I mean, how did this happen?
With all due respect to former Senator McGovern, he's dead wrong about that. The big business, big lie is that that's what it would do. What it actually does is it takes the power out of the boss's hand, out of the employer's hands, puts it into the workers' hands. So if the workers want to go about organizing their union and forming and joining their union by a secret ballot election, they can choose to do that. Under current current law, if they don't want to go that route, employers can still force workers into that route.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that employers want to force workers into that secret ballot, so-called secret ballot election, is because then the employers have a whole set of rules and regulations that they can pursue in a campaign against the union. So this Employee Free Choice Act takes the power and puts it into the workers' hands. It prevents employers from forcing it on the workers.
Right. Is McGovern still holding that position, do you know?
I think he is, unfortunately. He is.
Amazing.
It's sad, but he is.
It really is. Doug Cunningham, laborradio.org. You can get all the news. There's a lot more news where this came from. Check it out, laborradio.org, Workers Independent News. Thanks, Doug.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Welcome back, my friends, and downright strange stuff going on. I'm telling you, the world is crazy. Sometimes, well, at least the folks at U.S. News and World Report, the notoriously conservative weekly news magazine, they've decided to ask their readers who'd run the best daycare center. And no, they didn't ask if it would be Harry Reid or John Boehner, or whether, you know, who. No. They apparently, in the world of U.S. News and World Report, the only people qualified to run daycare centers are women. So you have your choice. You can vote for Michelle Obama, Sarah Palin, Hillary Clinton, or Nancy Pelosi. Who do you want running your daycare center? Downright strange. Also, at a Lincoln Day dinner speech over the weekend, Senator Jim Bunning, the Republican from Kentucky, predicted that within 9 months, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg would be dead. He reiterated his support of conservative judges, saying that's going to be in place very shortly because Ruth Bader Ginsburg has cancer, bad cancer, the kind you don't get better from. Yeah, apparently he's got an MD degree in his spare time. Maybe he, took one of those evening classes. Fact of the matter is, for those of you who didn't read it in the paper, she had surgery. The cancer is in a very early stage, pancreatic cancer. They took it out. They took out the surrounding glands, I'm assuming the lymph glands. There was no evidence that it had spread or in any way was any threat. And, in fact, she expects to be back to work. Or at least that's the official word. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Steve in Washington. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. First of all, it's a pleasure to speak with you, and I'm looking forward to seeing you on the March 7th cruise here.
Oh, great.
And I'll be sponsoring. And I wanted to let you know that I had spoke to both of my senators here in Washington State, Senator Patty Murray's office and Maria Cantwell, and also Representative Norm Dix's office about the Siegelman case.
Uh-huh.
And I had a very lengthy conversation with Senator Murray's office. The staffers were really interested in why I was calling and who was instructing me to call. So I mentioned that I had heard on your show, of course, Don Siegelman speak, and let them know just exactly my feelings on it, which was that Karl Rove is a criminal and that if you and I ignored congressional subpoenas, we would be put in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And that Mr. Rove and company seemed to be able to get away with this. And so I also urged them to follow up with this. And the staffers said that they had been receiving quite a few calls on this matter. And so it definitely perked their ears in interest, and just wanted to call and remind all your listeners that they can do this pretty easily also. And I think we can have an effect if we use the tools that are there for us to use.
Yeah, well said, we can. And keep in mind, this happens first in the House of Representatives. So calling Senator Murray's office or Senator Cantwell in Washington State, great idea. And you want to do that because it may end up before the Senate as well, or they may both have to vote on it. I'm not sure of all the arcana of the thing. But the House of Representatives is the place where it begins. And so you have a single person who represents you in the House of Representatives. I'm not sure who it would be. Is it Jim McDermott there, or do you know who your representative is? And
yes, yeah. It's Norm Dix in our district.
Okay. Well,
he's an entrenched Democrat that's been here forever. Usually wins his elections by over 65%, but it doesn't really seem to have a real grasp on subpoena issues. At a Democratic picnic about a year and a half ago, Mr. Dix was asked, well, what if they ignore the subpoenas? And his response was that, oh, they would never do that.
Well, you know, apparently it's time to let him know. So I would encourage you to give him a call, too.
Yes, exactly. I have, and I will continue to call him also.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Steve.
And thanks again, Tom. Yep.
Great to hear from you. Bye-bye. I appreciate the call. Arthur in Boston. Hey, Arthur, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I just wanted to point out something you were talking about last week. You were talking about how certain politicians have done that they've moved certain things somewhere, and that those states have been, Republican states have been profiting by certain types of things more than the Democratic states.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the U.S. Army for 9 years. I was in 1st Infantry and 1st Armor Divisions both. Those infantry divisions are both moving back to the United States with the, by 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And, there was a lot of right-wing, radio discussion about the base realignment and closure, saying that we didn't belong in Germany because those units didn't belong in Germany because as a protest against the fact that Germany voted against the Iraq invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Those units are going to be moving back to Texas, and
surprise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, First Armor is going to Texas, and First Infantry to I think it was Oklahoma. And I'm just wondering if Texas needed any more protection than it already had.
Yeah. Maybe this is why the governors and the folks representing those states feel that they really don't need any part of the stimulus package, because they see a few bucks coming their way from the military, and that's gonna be their stimulus.
But, well, I do know that in Germany that that the U.S. Federal government spends a lot of money there when they were in Germany, and they're reducing those troop sizes drastically now.
Yeah.
And so they were the two largest warfighting divisions outside of the United States.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting point. Arthur, thanks a lot for the call and for the heads up on that. Annie in San Francisco. Hey, Annie.
Hi, Tom. I have a quick question about currencies.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had most of my money out of the dollar and in predominantly Swiss and Euro, and it's taken a huge beating, and I just kept thinking, betting against the dollar long-term because of all the debt and da-da-da. But now things have gotten worse, with the Central European countries, and I'm just wondering, what you see sort of short-term and long-term with the dollar in relation to these currencies and then also in relation to gold.
I've never tried to look at these things short-term. I'm not... one of my brothers actually day trades currencies for fun. He's not, on a good month, he'll make $5,000, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But he really knows about this stuff. And the last time I was in Michigan, he was, just blew my mind, everything that he had learned about all this stuff. I have always just looked at the long term. I mean, to the extent that we're invested in the market, as it were, we bought gold stocks. We bought Canadian stocks, actually. Many of our stocks are Canadian stocks, so that we were getting both the Canadian dollar and, the gold or oil or whatever it may be. most of our stocks, most of what we have are commodities. I don't know if that's smart or not, frankly. I don't put myself out as an investment advisor. The one thing that most investment advisors do suggest is that you buy something and sit on it for a period of time, and that's what I've always done, and it's done us well. And there have been times when we've been way down and times when we've been way up, and I just, you know, kind of ride it out. I do think that the long-term prospect for the dollar, for the U.S. dollar, is not a good one. Although
even with the problems going on in Europe, you still think ours is still worse?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Europe's infrastructure is in solid shape. They're still manufacturing things in Europe. They're still protecting their domestic economy to a large extent. Europe is somewhat distorted by the UK and Ireland because those two countries bought into Thatcherism and Reaganomics, mm-hmm. and it's interesting to see the commentators on TV going, "Oh, Europe is having bigger problems than we are." Tell that to the Swedes, you know. Tell that to the Danes.
Part of the euro, though.
Yeah, well, tell that to the Germans, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Germany's down a little bit.
But the Spanish economy is having problems, and the Greek, and even Italy, and now these emerging, you know, Poland and Czech, have you heard about?
Well, part of the big problem is the fact that the European Union, I think, got too big too fast.
And I agree.
They're absorbing many of these former Soviet states, and they really don't have the manufacturing. And the benefit, really the only thing that those folks had to bring to the table was the cheap labor.
Right.
And you know, in a few cases of natural resources, but you know, the whole country, the whole world right now is going through a massive realignment. And in terms of investment strategy, I frankly don't know what to do about it, other than, you know, we've got about half of our money just parked in cash, mm-hmm. and the other half parked in commodities, on the assumption that over time, you know, looking over the next 5 to 10 years, mm-hmm. We are going to be running low on oil around the world, and that's going to be expensive. And I think that gold is where people are going to flee to. I think that the U.S. stock market still has a ways down to go.
Yeah.
But I may be wrong. You know, there's a couple of possible scenarios. We have been printing money like crazy. The Fed, you know, loaning $2 trillion to the banks and whatnot. It's, you know, that and our debt. It's entirely possible that they may try to deflate us out of it, which means that our currency, you know, really crashes.
Right.
You know, and your Swiss francs or whatever it may be, or euros may become very, very valuable. On the other hand, it's possible that we could see massive deflation in the United States. I just don't know. So I'm taking a cautious course on that, and I'm just not giving people advice. 2:45.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Are we prisoners in the land of the brave and the bold, held by indifference, or hearts grown hard and cold? And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand? Children of the world, you have the right to sing and dance, run and play, let your dreams take flight. As the innocent die, you rulers carry the shame. And if we stand idly by, we share in the blame. And oh, America, do we care?
I think most of us do. Welcome back, 9 minutes before the hour. Paul Chappell is with us. He is a former captain in the U.S. Army and the author of a new book, Will War Ever End? A Soldier's Vision for Peace for the 21st Century. Paul Chappell, Paul K. Chappell, PaulKChappell.com, his website/author. Paul, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tom. And I'm still a captain in the Army, by the way.
Oh, you are. You're still active duty. Okay. My apologies.
Right.
Your book raises a very provocative question, which is it possible to end war?
Would you like me to talk about that briefly?
Please riff on that, yes.
To a lot of people today, world peace is a cliche. To a lot of people today, world peace is a joke. And that's a very dangerous thing when weapons have become so destructive that they threaten human survival. And in order to solve the problems of the 21st century, we have to take world peace out of the realm of being a cliche. We have to help people take world peace seriously. And the only way we can do that is by showing that world peace is possible, practical, and necessary. So the question I begin with is, will war ever end? Will war just go on forever? And if war does go on forever, mankind won't survive, because 100 years ago, we were developing automatic machine guns. Today, we have enough nuclear weapons to destroy the planet several times over, and technology is going to continue to evolve exponentially. So war is a serious threat to human survival. And to answer the question, will war ever end, we have to answer much deeper questions. Most importantly, are human beings naturally violent or naturally peaceful? If human beings are naturally violent, it would be naive to assume that war will ever end. But I think the evidence is overwhelming that human beings are naturally peaceful and that war can end in the 21st century.
Why? How? Let me reframe that. Let me preface this. And I'm
right.
Paul, I don't know if this is in your book or not, but one of the great, most brilliant ethnographies of Native Americans was done by Peter Farb. He wrote a book called Man's Rise to Civilization back in the 60s. And it's out of print now, but you can get copies of it used. It's out of print in large part because he died. But he documents in great detail the nature of the cultures of 20 or 30 different Native American tribes around the United States. And, I mean, it's just a brilliant and fascinating insight, but one of the most important and fascinating parts of it is how he blows apart the myth of war. He points out that there are a few exceptions to this that he also documents, and they tended to be tribes moving in consequence of climate change. For example, the Dene-speaking people coming south 500-600 years ago into the Pueblo-speaking people's territory and becoming the Navajo and the Apache and basically having conflict with the Hopi. But with those exceptions, one tribe would have conflict with another tribe, but it never occurred to them to have war with the other tribe the way that you and I define war. They didn't want to kill off everybody in the other tribe. They needed that other tribe basically for breeding stock, I mean, to maintain a healthy genome. You know, they would trade in ways, you know, their young men and women would intermarry in some ways. They needed that other tribe to trade with. They didn't want to have the other tribe's land because that meant that they got the ghosts that came along with it. That was sacred. The whole idea, and in fact, the Pequot Wars in the United States where a U.S., and this was before it was U.S., it was in the 1600s, a British general surrounded one of the Indian villages, lit it on fire, and then shot everybody as they left. The Pequots were so horrified, or maybe it was the Penobscots, and it was the Pequots who were being killed. I don't have the details in front of me. I wrote about it in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. They were so horrified that they refused to participate, to interact with the whites anymore. They said, this is obscene. This is a crime against nature. And, the whites said, oh, these guys are just cowards. They don't know how to fight a war. They don't want to fight a war. I mean, is it possible that what you and I refer to as war is actually a relatively recent cultural aberration, a temporary mental illness in the history of humankind, and we can cure ourselves of it?
That's a very good question. In early tribes, warfare is very impractical, because let's say that I have a tribe of 10 people, and I try to conquer another tribe of 10 people, and only two people in my tribe are seriously injured or killed. I've just lost 20% of the manpower in my tribe, which is going to severely limit my ability to survive, because you have enough to contend with dealing with drought, famine, disease, hunger, predators in the wild. So waging war against other tribes is very impractical as a survival mechanism. But the framework I use to understand this is, if you want to understand human health, you have to study illness. If you want to understand peace, you have to understand war. And all over the planet, people are physically ill, but nobody would say that we're supposed to be physically ill. When people become sick, it's an anomaly. Something has gone wrong. So So when warfare happens, it's because something has gone wrong. But when warfare happens, a lot of people say, oh, it's because we're naturally violent, despite the fact that most people who go to war go insane.
Yeah. And I would argue that it is a form of national and cultural insanity. Paul, we've just scratched the surface. Let me encourage people to check out your book, Will War Ever End? A Soldier's Vision. Go ahead.
And my website's willwarEverEnd.com.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for that.
All right. Will Thank
War,
you, Tom.
You're welcome. WillWarEverEnd.com. Paul Chappell, the author of Will War Ever End? A Soldier's Vision for Peace in the 21st Century. Looks like definitely a good one. Coming up tomorrow, Tony Blankley and the Institute of Medicine. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.